There are many extraordinary facts contained within Christopher Plummer's new memoir. Aside from being one of our most distinguished actors, did you know that on August 27th, 1962, Christopher Plummer chased down a group of armed Cuban exile terrorists in the speedboat and successfully disarmed them with a mere carrot, turning these terrorists into lifelong vegetarians? He was named an honorary Cuban by Fidel Castro, but he declined the honor, pointing out that he was already a Canadian, and he fled to Montreal, taking with him some of Fidel's finest cigars. On March 2nd, 1971, secretly working as an espionage agent, Christopher Plummer tracked down the Weather Underground members who had planted a bomb in the men's room of the U.S. Capitol building. By reciting only 5 lines of Shakespeare, he terrified these men and caused them to renounce their violent ways. One of the men still whimpers whenever he sees the sound of music. Do not underestimate Christopher Plummer. He will destroy you with a mere flash of his smile. Okay, so I am here with Christopher Plummer, the man behind such indelible characters as Cyrano de Bergerac, Richard III, General Chang, a certain captain who has been rather popular and the like, and who's now playing the role of author with his book In Spite of Myself. Christopher, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It's a very pleasant wintry day. But I have to ask you first an innocuous question. What character role gets you the best table at a restaurant? Is it generally Von Trapp, or are there other roles that are perhaps commensurate in some sense with a topographically advantageous five-star dining experience?
No, I think, yes, of course. I suppose the film has... the film, The Sound of Music, is the... I'm best known for, just like poor Clark Gable was best known for Gone with the Wind, which he hated.
Yeah,
but I suppose that's the one that... But I think that European restaurants obviously know me from other work, because that's more important. I think it wasn't all that popular in Europe.
Yeah, so what in Europe is the role that sort of gets people's
attention? I don't know. Probably is a succession of roles, and perhaps it's my roles in France when I played France, but in France, particularly France, that like Triple Cross or The Night of the Generals or various films that I made in Europe.
Gotcha.
Will probably mean more to them.
I wanted to ask you, dealing with the actual book, Lillian Hellman, you point out, was one of the few playwrights of the 1950s who had a certain control over the production. You point out that during The Lark, she took over from director Joseph Anthony, and she said, "I shall give my notes first."
Yes.
But you also point out that her notes were clearer and more concise than Mr. Anthony's. And so I must also ask, also I want to bring up Arch Oboler later because I'm a fan of his and you take umbrage with him, but I'm wondering if you feel that some theatrical productions, there's a certain advantage to having the playwright give notes, or is this a kind of unusual circumstance in the case of Lillian Hellman?
Well, I think it was an unusual circumstance. I don't know that the playwrights perhaps know enough about the interpretation of others of their work to sort of suddenly take over. And but Lillian Hellman was an exceedingly bright woman of the world as well, and she knew politics, and she knew all sorts of subjects, and she knew how to handle people. Her manner was extraordinary. When you met her, for the first time, you felt you'd known her for many, many years. She put you immediately at ease because she was such a strong woman. Her charisma was so, her voice was so intimate. So she knew how to control a situation better than most directors do.
Yeah.
And there were no sort of analytical problems that she was going through like so many directors go through. There was no suffering for one's art. Here was a practical author who knew exactly how she wanted to musically see the play in her mind. And after all, she had given it, I think, the best translation into English that Christopher Fry had translated it before her, but was rather florid.
Yeah.
In comparison to her very modern, stark, contemporary style. And she had every right to come up and say... Also, she was one of the most powerful women in our business.
Yeah.
She ran Hollywood as an author. She was the most powerful author in Hollywood. And on the stage as well. So her, but isn't it wonderful that a woman can make her point so clearly that she only needs about 10 minutes and then it transformed our performances into the right direction. Whereas dear Joe Anthony, who was so sweet and such a gentleman, but so into therapy of some kind that he's went on. No, I mean, isn't
the psychoanalytical,
but isn't it a very American thing? Anyways, he would go into it for, I mean, such long lengths of explanations and deeper problems. And we all, come on, Joe, shut up. We want to go home. So it was only the clarification made by Lillian Hellman that we remembered really in the end.
But then you have some plays, for example, like Death of a Salesman, yes, which are very specific about how the stage is laid out and where the actors have to be. I mean, in a situation like that, that's why I bring up this interesting notion of whether the playwright may know more than the director or the director may know more than the playwright, and where interpretation comes into play, which, of course, is where the actors come in.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious if it's a kind of a case-by-case basis on a particular play or a director or whatnot.
No, I think most of the time the directors who directed Arthur Miller, it was Kazan,
yeah,
who was, again, a very strong and the visionary director and born to bring a contemporary or born to change the contemporary scene in his own way, a much stronger creature than Joseph Anthony.
Sure.
And again, in a much higher and loftier position.
And a clearer voice.
And the playwrights were all genuflected to him and bowed to his wishes. Oh, God, yes, and had every right to. So there's no stage directions in The Death of a Salesman.
You write of Hamlet. Most think of him as a sort of everyman, that there is a Hamlet within all of us, but all of him in all of us? Hardly. Very few of us could ever be as cultivated, refined, noble, or scholarly. And you observe the biggest obstacle an actor faces is when the audience has a preconceived notion of what Hamlet is.
Yes.
But I should point out that Andre Serban did a version of Hamlet with Liv Schreiber a few years ago, and he was talking up the everyman quality. And, of course, there's the famous Coleridge line, "I have a smack of Hamlet myself." So I'm curious if it's not really contending with the idea of Hamlet as everyman, but rather this notion of the audience wanting to see some perception of Hamlet, and you, as an interpreter, having to either play into that or you fall into this idea of maybe presenting the illusion of everyman while also being distinct. Is this sort of what
your question is almost as long as Joseph Anthony's directions, and just as muddled. But what I mean by everyman is there is an everyman in Hamlet, and every member of the audience must, whether they like it or not, try to identify with him in the sense. And there is the chance in that extraordinary role of them being able to do that. Then there's the remoter side of Hamlet, which is the urbane and the wit and the wisdom in one so young, and the style that is perhaps takes him away from being identified, but particularly with modern audiences who probably don't know what style is.
Yeah.
So it is such a mélange of extraordinary qualities, Hamlet, that it makes it the greatest role ever written, I think. There is no doubt of that. And he must have also the great temper. He must possess the great temper in order to frighten the audience. He must have all sorts of qualities all in one, because it's written that way. It's written as a great symphony of a part. And unless you obey the codas, the climaxes, and the stresses musically, you're not anywhere near finished playing Hamlet.
Well, this is an interesting distinction, because I also know that you took James Earl Jones to task in this book for approaching Othello with a more analytical framework. And I'm wondering, yes, if you believe that Shakespeare needs to always have this great emotional poetry to it, or whether there is room, given the complexities, for numerous types of adaptations.
Well, of course there's room, but you've got to have all of them. You can't deny me. You can't come on and just sort of say, all right, I'm going to play Hamlet as a junkie, period. Please. Where would he be able to think so clearly? How could he give out such brilliant thoughts if he was a junkie? Wrong. It would take him days to say one line. So, of course, James Earl Jones was fantastic in the prose section of the play. What interested me and what disappointed me at the same time was that this great organ of, with his great organ of a voice, which he has to his fingertips, why he did not let go in the great poetic passages. He just decided not to, whether he was embarrassed or he decided he would do them in a kind of more sort of monotone, realistic way. There was only one great moment where he let fly. It was about the Pontic Sea and that whole imagery in the scene with the famous scene with Iago. There he let fly, and it was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful. And then you wanted him to go on at moments doing the same thing again.
So I take it then that you're not really a fan of creative interpretations like, say, the R&J or the Buzz Larman approach.
I thought that as a contemporary Romeo and Juliet, it was by far the best I'd ever seen. I thought it was excellent. And I didn't think that the poetry was mangled, because I think somebody had helped. Obviously, I don't know if this is true, but it seemed that someone had helped Leonardo DiCaprio with his words, because he stretched them he stretched them out correctly.
Yeah.
So even though it was a modern piece, he obeyed the rhythm of the poetry.
Huh.
And I thought, and the girl did too. She was a little behind him in that, but he was excellent. I thought that was remarkable. And because that was an honest departure all the way down the line. It didn't pretend to be half modern, half a sort of an allegiance to Shakespeare. It was a modern take on Romeo and Juliet. And, of course, the scene at the opening of the picture was perfect, because it was the most violent scene I've ever seen in a production of Romeo and Juliet. And stage directors should watch that scene and try and emulate in somehow when they direct it on the stage.
Huh, interesting. Well, I also wanted to ask you about your daughter, Amanda. You write of her, "I long to have the same sort of freedom and daring that came so naturally to her. It upset me, not as a father, but as an artist, and I couldn't help admiring her and her fearless courage more than ever. But surely, after the success you have had with both Barrymore and The Insider, in which you have had a good offering of scripts, I mean, there is a bit of freedom here. I'm wondering why you feel that you don't necessarily have this."
I have it. But I don't have it to the extent of Amanda, because I grew up in a very with two methods: the modern American kind of method and the classic theater, the discipline of the classic theater, which Amanda did not.
Yeah,
and she has a sort of free madness to her that she is not worried about rules of the game, and throws herself absolutely unabashed into everything. She seems to have not even a kind of discrete idea of how to control it. It's all up front, and that's what I mean by I relish that. I think that's just marvelous. I wish I had it too.
You're too far along in your career to throw away the rules?
No, I'm not. It's a different kind of freedom I'm talking about. Surely that was clear when I wrote it. Because I describe a film that she was in which she was stark naked, and it was an absolutely ghastly, ghastly, horrible movie as far as... I don't mean it was a bad movie. It was a horrible movie as far as violence was concerned.
And Butterfly Kiss.
Butterfly Kiss. But she was extraordinary in it. Absolutely extraordinary. Fearless. I don't think I could have done that kind of thing. I would always have to sort of pretend that there was some taste needed or kind of resist the total abandon.
I'm curious why you turned down Gladiator. Was this perhaps because of bad experiences shooting The Fall and Rise of the Roman Empire, which you depict in this
turned
book?
Turned down or? Gladiator? No. I was turned down.
You were turned down.
Oh, yeah. Russell wanted me in it.
Oh, I see.
And I don't think... who's the director's name?
It was Ridley Scott.
Yeah, Ridley. I don't think Ridley wanted me. I think he wanted Richard Harris. And I think Richard Harris was wonderful in it.
Yeah.
And he was right to have Richard Harris, because Richard Harris looked the part. He didn't even have to cut his hair.
Yeah. Well, you also turned down David O. Selznick. Are there any other roles, perhaps, that you may regret that you have turned down? Or?
No, I haven't turned down that many. But I turned down David Selznick for for a good reason. I wish I'd known him a little earlier in his life, because I would have, that's the kind of producer I would have given my ITs to work for.
Yeah.
He had such a marvelous sense of grandeur and taste and romance about him, and there's nobody like him anymore. But I would have also loved to have worked with him on the project he offered me, but it wasn't just that project.
Yeah.
It was a 7-year contract. And in those days, the independents were coming in, and there were no such things as 7-year contracts anymore. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have 7 years out of my life without doing Hamlet, Macbeth. I wanted to go back to the classic theater and learn my trade.
I have to ask you, because I'm an old-time radio fan, about Arch Oboler's Night of the Auk. First off, he doesn't come across very well. I mean, you call the dialogue in this subhuman English.
Yes.
And I have to ask, because here's a guy who created some extraordinarily distinct radio with Lights Out. Yeah. And I'm wondering, did you look at the script before you took this particular role? Why did you find out about it?
Yes, we did. Really? We all did.
Huh.
Sidney Lumet did, Claude Rains did, Wendell Corey did, myself did. I think he was very lucky to have such a good cast. We all read it. It read beautifully. It played disastrously.
It was more for radio than theater, perhaps.
Exactly.
I see.
It was a radio play, and I think it would have... He was very ahead of his time, very much so, and I think I say so.
I give him due
credit for being an extraordinary guy, partly an inventor of 3D.
Yeah. And Shatner actually played your role in the television version of that.
That's absolutely right. You're right. Yeah. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. So I don't know if you
He was just an extraordinarily pompous little man. And he got in everybody's way when we were trying so hard to make his radio dialogue, very florid on the stage, sound kind of believable. And as I say, the only person who made it sound believable was Claude Rains, who had this booming voice anyway, so he'd make anything sound believable.
But with so many talents involved with this production, I mean, surely you could have seen that it would have been more ideal for radio than theater. I'm wondering why that...
You don't always. Because it read so well, and I thought, well, maybe, I think we all felt that maybe once it's on its feet, it will take care of itself. We don't always know. It's not possible to always know without having a go.
Yeah.
But it didn't take us long once we were on our feet to realize that we were in deep merd.
Yeah.
And that we were going to have to either close or work very hard to make it open successfully.
Well, this brings up an interesting notion of when you get a script that you say yes to, do you perform it or do you just read it in your mind and think that, okay, well, this will actually be good for
most of the time I can tell now. I'm more experienced at those things. But it was tough then because we were seduced a bit by the verse. It was an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Blank verse, modern blank verse. And Christopher Fry had just disappeared from the theater, really, by that time, or was disappearing from the theater. His wonderful day was kind of coming to an end.
Yeah.
And people were a little bit... It was mighty florid.
Got it.
Beautiful, though, but mighty florid. And so this was another kind of verse drama, which people were used to. You see, it wasn't like now when you'd get it and say, oh, my God, this should be radio right away. Let's put it on here. But then, no, because we'd been used to verse drama by modern authors.
Well, we can't be done for radio now because this is the only Western country that doesn't have a subsidized radio drama scenario. I mean, do you miss doing radio? I mean, I know you've done some voice work for film.
Oh, no. I started on radio.
Yeah.
Yeah. And terrific radio, too. Some of the best in the world was done in Toronto in the 40s.
Yeah.
And we had that exchange with the BBC third program. Great radio was done there, if I may say so. Not because I was part of it, but it just was. We did everything modern, contemporary, and classical.
Yeah.
Those 3-hour plays, with full orchestra, 60 musicians, with original scores for Peer Gynt, for Dickens.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful stuff. With a group of actors who knew how to how to give you 20 different voices if required.
Do you think that the decline of radio, in addition to the decline of the golden age of television, which you write about in this book, is partly responsible for the lack of decent writing these days, or is it a matter of commercialization of the medium?
Well, it's both, isn't it? I think commercialization of the media is number one, and secondly, yes, I think the departure of the radio, top radio drama writing, is sorely, sorely missed.
Yeah.
And people nowadays don't know anything about it.
I also wanted to ask you about your start with Ruth Chatterton, who was a star of the silent screen. I mean, you didn't actually get your start with her, but she actually led you in the right direction to your agent.
Yeah.
And I'm curious because, I mean, she said the first thing you do when you come to New York is to look me up. I'll take you to dinner. There are some very important people I want you to meet.
Yes.
And you did look her up. You did get an agent, and you were in steady work ever since. This leads to two questions I have. Was there ever any kind of lean period from that particular trajectory, despite your early points stiffing hotels and the like? And also, have you made any efforts to reach out to other young actors along these lines? You describe getting Diana Barrymore an audition for Elia Kazan. And so I'm wondering if there have been other efforts to try to help other young actors along these lines to take me to New York or that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've tried to help a couple of young actors, whom I thought had talent, who came to me and said, you know, you've been here longer than I have. Can you give me a hand? And by putting them in the direction, I haven't done anything that was very self-sacrificing. I've just simply gave them introductions and said, good luck. That's all I can say, because it's not up to me. It's up to you. And then I would not presume to tell young actors what to do and God knows there's enough of a fight to keep in it yourself.
Yeah.
I was lucky. I never had a lean period. If it was lean, it was due to my bar bills.
But also, I mean, this makes me ask, well, how much of acting is about who you know? It seems to me that you got your start largely because of who you knew. And
yes.
So I'm wondering if it's just an indelible part of the process of being
a
working
actor. Of course it is. I suppose you have to be at the right place at the right time in any profession. I wasn't always, because I write self-deprecatingly about the fact that my timer is always a bit off key, that I'd arrived when the moment had passed.
Occasionally.
But I guess my start in Canada also, because I knew that lady who ran that outdoor Shakespeare company, and she was a friend of the family's. Then she got me started there. Of course, I think that happens to everybody. You have to know somebody.
Yeah.
You can't do it totally on your own. And I was lucky. I knew some, my family knew, were connected to some cultured people. So they were of great help to me.
I was curious also about your early start. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Shatner. You worked with him in Montreal Theater.
Yeah.
And he, in fact, was your understudy.
And radio. Yep.
And he was your understudy for Henry V and essentially did everything that you didn't do and
became
a huge success based off of it. And, of course, Star Trek VI. But Shatner has this reputation of hogging the limelight a little bit. Did you observe any of this?
Yes, I do. That was what was such fun about it. Because I knew that if he was going to go on for me, he was going to do everything opposite to what I was going to do, to hog the limelight, to be different, to be his own master. And of course I knew that son of a bitch was going to be a star. You could see it.
Yeah.
And that was great. No, that was funny and great.
Was this one of the motivating factors towards getting well in the hospital, knowing that Shatner was...
Absolutely. Yeah. I even left the operating table, as you know, in the book, and the morphine had run off. I was about to go out the door of the hospital, and the nurse said, where are you going? I said, I got a performance tonight. And she said, no, you haven't. You're going back to bed. And that was all because I heard Shatner was going on. I wasn't going to let him do it. But, he didn't become a star because of that one performance he gave.
Yeah.
Because only that audience saw him. But he became a star very shortly thereafter.
You have very kind words to say about Jeffrey Unsworth. You say that he's the best director of photography because he set up lights and shots, all without a sound, just with gesture.
Yes, and he was extraordinary.
Yeah, and the thing that's interesting about this, though, is that you require a considerable amount of concentration for all of your roles, and I'm wondering why that is? Because other actors sometimes thrive off of a social environment, but you need this concentration, and you also write about throwing people out at rehearsals and the like. And so I have to ask why you require that intense solidification, I suppose, on stage.
Well, I don't as much in the last, like, two or three decades have I needed quite so much concentration, because now I'm used to it. You don't get much chance these days. There's so much noise around anyway. You better get used to it and then shut it out as best you can. But no, I was just not any more than any actor who was kind of serious about working in the theater. I didn't particularly like people coming in and sitting in front of me, strangers that I had not known, and I always threw them out until if they were polite enough to be introduced in the beginning and asked if they could possibly sit, and then I would probably say, yeah, but go in the back and be quiet. But when they come unannounced, that's when I see red.
Yeah.
And I think you would, or anybody would.
Sure. Well, I also have to ask you, every actress nearly that you worked with, you develop a mad crush on. And this is interesting. Just about every one. I mean, I think there are at least, I think I stopped counting at about the 17 mark, the actress you had the crush on. I mean, I have to ask you, is this who
crush?
You are?
I did not have a crush on Dame Edith Evans. I did not have a crush on Judith Anderson or Catherine Cornell, all of them, you know, my mother's age,
yeah,
practically.
Yeah, but you did have quite a lot of crushes.
Yeah, you're damn right I did.
Know, I'm wondering why this is. Does this come with the emotional requirements of the performance?
Well, no, it just because I'm very strange. I like girls, and I know that's very strange.
It is very strange.
Very strange, but...
we'll have to call the Mormons. Sort you.
I get crushes on people. I'm an incurable romantic. And that doesn't mean that I immediately jump on them, but I hold that crush, and sometimes it's very valuable to have, particularly if it's a leading lady. It's nice to be able to crush. I think once you have an affair with your leading lady, that is a very bad thing.
Yeah.
You could tell by watching Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor in Antony and in Cleopatra, the film, that all their passionate and sexy and exciting moments had been exhausted off screen. So by the time they both got on, they were sort of so exhausted and bored, they kind of just walked sleepily through that endless picture.
There was one last question I had for you, and that pertains to, again, writing. You note that for The Sound of Music, you wanted a rewrite of the character so that Von Trapp was not nearly
not quite
as cardboard.
So square, yes.
And likewise, you also mentioned that in The Insider, you asked Eric Roth to bring up the more sensitive side of Mike Wallace. But this is an interesting question because, well, if the material is there, I mean, should you as an actor interfere with the writing process? I mean, isn't it your job to interfere in the sense
they should be only too glad that I have some suggestions to make. And indeed, they were very appreciative. And I certainly don't go in and say, I want that scene changed. I don't behave like that. And I said, would you ever consider showing a softer side just for a second of Mike Wallace?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it'll look like he's just the sort of kind of hardcore journalist all the way through. Let's show him that I've seen on television when his son died. He was very touching and very moving about that. Let's see something like that in him. Now that is a bright suggestion, and of course they listened. I didn't expect them to do me the favor of doing so, but they did.
But the text itself is it. That's sacred.
The text was terrific, and I loved that, the text for that film. It was hard, unsentimental. It was damn well written. Eric Roth is a damn good screenwriter.
Yeah.
And I just suddenly thought, for my own character, I might fight a little harder to get another color. And it paid off.
Sometimes, though, you need to sweeten the text a little bit, though, to get
always, except when you're dealing with Shakespeare. It's rather difficult to sweeten Shakespeare, or Ben Jonson.
Some have unfortunately tried to mixed results.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. And Sam Taylor. But, yeah, I think modern drama, you can. There is the moment where you can ask the author without feeling that you are being impudent or out of place. I mean, if I was working with Arthur Miller, I'm sure if we sat down for drinks afterwards, I the subject might come up, I'd say, "Do you think we could have a couple of laughs in this scene? you're a pretty stark playwright, Arthur. Would be nice to be relieved just for a second. Maybe the audience needs that break, you know, a couple of laughs, so then they can come back and get more tragedy." That sort of thing could happen.
But in the case of Neil Simon, he kept throwing new drafts at you all the time.
Now you
can't do anything about that.
No, that was from the ridiculous to the sublime, or the other way around. I mean, he never stopped. I said, "Stop already. I've got enough colors."
Yeah.
And it was terrifying having to learn all that stuff for the next night or the same night. Oh, you got a good memory, Chris. Let's throw all this. I'll give you a big long soliloquy for the second act. Oh, yeah. Jesus, Neil. All right, but it was always exciting because he was working so hard. You felt you had to play along with this, and you were very glad for the change too. It was never boring.
Well, Christopher, thanks for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.